I tell people all the time, I don't really know a product on this planet that we couldn't produce with seaweed. We can make all, like almost any biomaterial, pharmaceuticals, nutraceuticals. Like there's at least, well, I know two species of seaweeds that have been identified to fight COVID or the virus, not the, probably not the symptoms. So it's just, yeah, seaweeds are amazing. We're just learning about them right now. I mean, the diversity is amazing, and the Western world has only touched literally a handful of those in an in-depth way.
Welcome to Animalia, a podcast all about making it easy and inclusive to learn about this big, beautiful planet, the life we share it with, and how to protect it. This week on Animalia, we are diving into the fascinating and critical world of kelp. If you're not familiar, kelp is a type of seaweed that will likely be a really important part of our agricultural future as we move towards a more regenerative, environmentally friendly food system. Technically, kelp is not a plant. It's an algae that has many plant-like characteristics, but scientifically is in a separate kingdom called protists. And if you think eating an algae sounds gross, well, my guess is you probably already are eating fungus. And if we're really being critical, all of you listening sort of are a fungus, scientifically speaking, based on ancient evolution of life. Kelp naturally grow in rich, dense, shallow water ecosystems called kelp forests. As you'll learn today, these natural kelp forests are beautiful, rich with life, and a really important and valuable part of our oceans and the planet in the thousands of species they provide food and habitat for, the coasts they protect, the carbon they sequester, and the oxygen they produce. And since kelp grows so fast and regenerates so well, while being a really nutritious food source themselves, we're seeing a lot of momentum with kelp farming as a new source of regenerative agriculture, a much more planet-friendly way for harvesting food and nutrients than most large-scale single-crop terrestrial farming. We just got to figure out how to get people to want to eat it, as well as making sure we can scale these practices carefully. Joining us to discuss is Tiffany Stevens, the chief scientist at Seagrove Kelp, a kelp farm in southern Alaska. So let's meet Tiffany and dive in right after this short break. If you're not already subscribed to the Animalia newsletter, please do so. Each week, we break down three different stories designed to be read in 5 minutes or less. They'll make you a more informed advocate for this planet. We always focus on solutions, even when we are highlighting a problem, as it's critical we keep a solution-oriented lens towards the existential crises of climate change and biodiversity collapse. With the Animalia newsletter, you'll walk away each week feeling motivated and hopeful that we can and will solve these issues. Subscribe today at www.joinanimalia.com/newsletter. The link is in the description. And now, let's talk about kelp. To kick things off, I asked Tiffany how she found her way into the world of kelp. Now, kelp farming historically has really only been seen as a form of environmental remediation, kind of like terrestrial reforestation. But just like agroforestry is starting to become a wider practice, so too is kelp farming. Now, given we are still very much in the early days of doing this as a commercial enterprise, how did Tiffany find her way there?
So I fell into kelp or seaweeds totally by accident, which I think a lot of people really do, especially Westerners. But I was at Friday Harbor Labs, which is a marine lab with the University of Washington, and I was convinced that I was going to be studying shellfish like crabs or urchins my entire life. And the class that I took required me to learn about seaweeds. And I never really had given them any thought before that class. And that class was centered around going into the field, looking at seaweeds in their natural environment, bringing some back to the lab, drawing them, learning about their biology and their associations with other animals. And I just kind of fell in love. They're just so diverse and kind of alien looking, especially for someone that hasn't thought about them before. And so I was just fascinated. And I think that's where I really took off. And I just wanted to learn more about this water plant. And I tried to incorporate it into all of my future academic research to the best of my ability. So that took me to various places after I graduated with my undergraduate degree, like Alaska, Georgia, Fiji, eventually New Zealand, which is where I did my PhD, looking at nitrogen ecophysiology of giant kelp. And ultimately, that pathway led me to continued work with seaweeds. It brought me back to the Pacific Northwest. And totally by accident, I fell into the kelp farming world. Because I think a lot of seaweed scientists, they would say something like, oh, wouldn't it be fantastic to work on a kelp farm? It's kind of this like dream that no one could really ever touch. And then with this advent of kelp farming, just smacking Western world in the face, some opportunities have come up. And it just so happened that there was this kelp farm developer that wanted to develop a farm in exactly this small town that I was working in Southeast Alaska, where literally you would never expect to find anyone talking about kelp. And it was just super fortuitous. We met, so it was like, well, we're here for a reason. He hired me to be his chief scientist, and that's where I am today. And it's interesting. I think back about I don't know if I'm a believer in fate, but like, it's funny because my dad, he's a wheat farmer in Idaho. And like one of my other dads was a Bering Sea fisherman for crabs and fishes. And then I just end up kind of merging those two things, somehow into my professional interests. And it's been a lot of fun so far.
And getting to know Tiffany a bit, I have little doubt that she and kelp were meant to find each other. And what a beautiful thing it is when you meet a great human being who has really come across their true purpose in life and is able to make a living doing so. Now, before we dive into kelp farming, it's important to understand kelp forests. They're a cornucopia of life, much like coral reefs or mangrove forests. They provide such a critical role to ocean health, which means they provide a critical role to our health and well-being as well.
Yeah, so kelps are a group of seaweeds. So I like to pair it to my boss is that all kelps are seaweeds, but not all seaweeds are kelps. And so it's this group of brown seaweed called laminariales. And they're typically found in cool water areas, temperate zones, and also shallower areas where light penetrates pretty well. They need a lot of light to grow, and so they won't live that deep. And so you can find them all throughout, North America. And usually the species are, North America, the Pacific Northwest has one of the most diverse algal communities in the world. And so there are a lot of kelps in Washington, British Columbia, Alaska, California, Oregon, that you cannot find elsewhere.
Yeah, is it correct that... is it specifically bull kelp is one of the kelp species that's found sort of Northern California up through Alaska?
Yeah, that's right. Bull kelp is, I think, one of the most prominent kelps that you might, if a word is used endemic, it just means only found in that location. And so I know that I just saw someone on Twitter find a washed up bull kelp in Japan, and it like caused a craze for their local community because they never see it over there, but they just revere kelp so much. And so it was kind of like the sea dragon coming ashore for them. Bull kelp is, I think, the most well-known endemic species.
And in terms of the variety of life kelp support, I think the two things that always come to mind when I think of ecosystems that house such a wide array of life is, and it's very common, right? The Brazilian Amazon, the Amazon in general, or coral reefs. And it's true. They both house a tremendous amount of biodiversity. When I started learning about kelp, it seemed like, well, they're right up there in terms of the biodiversity they house and just the sort of volume of species that are endemic to kelp ecosystems. What's the sort of best way to understand that component of it?
Yeah, well, so these other areas, the thing that links all of these super diverse high species load is productivity. Corals, mangroves, kelp systems, they're just so productive, which means that they're really good at converting local resources like light and nutrients into a biomass that other organisms can take advantage of. And so kelp specifically are diverse in that role. They're great spots for other organisms to hide, even if they're not doing anything else with the kelp, they're just using it for shelter. Kelp is a wonderful food source for a lot of these organisms as well. And it also supports this really rich microbial community because of all of the changes in seawater chemistry associated with the productivity. And that microbial community supports these invertebrates and fishes as well. And so it's just this hot spot of life.
And as part of that, kelp forests are really productive in terms of carbon sequestration as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. They are very fast growers. Kelp makes the headlines all the time, especially in California. There's, what is the quote? It's something like, it grows a meter a day. Some people quote 2 meters a day. And so it's just this very fast growth rate that is tangible for the human eyeball. You can see a daily change.
The variety of life in a healthy kelp forest is quite spectacular. It includes a number of ocean plants, shellfish like oysters and mussels, sea urchins and sea stars, rockfish, and the ever-endearing sea otter. Species use kelp for habitat and food, and also protection. Mammals as large as gray whales have been observed hiding amongst the long, dense kelp forests as a safe haven from killer whales. Now, when it comes to carbon sequestration, a healthy bull kelp forest typically sequesters up to 20 times more carbon than a terrestrial forest of the same size. Now, this is because kelp transform carbon dioxide into seaweed biomass at an absurdly high rate given how fast they grow, sometimes as much as an entire foot in one day. Bull kelp forests, which are the common version found off the Pacific coast ranging from Mexico up through Alaska, where Tiffany works, can grow as high as 50 meters tall. Those who have had the privilege of swimming through a bull kelp forest often cite it as a kind of spiritual experience. So I asked Tiffany what it's like to have a job where she can do that on a routine basis.
Well, when I swim through a kelp forest, it feels, I guess, interactive. It feels, for me, friendly and engaging. Like you just hit, so, and it also depends on what kelp you're diving with, but these organisms are just so flexible, and the water environment is obviously fluid, and with waves and surge and currents, things, they dance in front of you. And so it just feels, I mean, there's the Beatles, the Octopus Garden. It feels like a garden in a lot of kelp beds. It feels like a place, especially when the sun's out, that you'd like to sit and watch the world around you for a little bit longer.
It's an organic
experience.
It's on my short list of something I need to do sooner than later, for sure.
Come on up to Alaska. I'll take you diving.
I will. I'll get on the next flight. Well, cool. And then what are the threats out there to kelp? And we know the larger threats to the ocean, especially the two kind of pillars of the ocean changes, ocean warming and acidification, and it's having effect on a variety of ecosystems. We've talked a lot on this podcast before on coral and how acidification is really, dismantling those ecosystems. Is similar effects happening to kelp, or is kelp more impacted by kind of overfishing or just coastal erosion? Like, what are some of the threats to the kelp forests we have?
So unlike some other organisms, with regard to ocean acidification, that aspect of climate change might be a net positive for a lot of seaweeds, primarily because dissolved CO2 in the ocean it's a nutrient for seaweeds. It's energetically efficient for them to take up relative to other carbon sources. And so we do see enhanced growth with elevated CO2. But as climate changes, there, of course, are other factors, notably oceanic warming. And that is certainly one of the primary risks for kelps. As I said earlier, this group of organisms really prefers cool, temperate water spaces. And so as those temperate areas begin to increase in temperature, it changes how those kelps interact with their environment in a lot of ways. And ultimately, you might say that they end up starving in high temperature. The increased temperature causes them to grow really fast, and then they might run out of nutrients that they need to grow, and then they become anemic and dissolve right in front of you. And so we're seeing this happen in the southern extent of a lot of Californian species, like Macrocystis, in fact. And then other than oceanic warming, another one that is hitting some localized areas is degradation of the coastline. So if upstream of a water system, there's a lot of deforestation, that can increase the sediment load in the water, and the increased sediment load can reduce the light that reaches the seaweeds. And so you might see not necessarily a reduction in the range of that species, but you might see them not growing as deep. You might not see them growing as happily or healthily. That lack of light might make them less resilient to other stressors like high temperature. And so you get these interactive effects.
Got it. And I believe there's also, at least on the Pacific coast, I think it was like 2013 or 14, we saw the sort of big epidemic of sea star wasting disease. And, you know, I believe that led to a sort of increase in volume of sea urchins, which, you know, if they overpopulate, can kind of eat through the roots of the kelp system. That also caused, you know, some damages to the kelp forests here on the Pacific coast, and have they been able to recover from that?
Oh yeah, definitely. So yeah, that's a great point. The disappearance of some of those larger predatory sea stars has increased the small and medium urchins that are in the ecosystem. We like to think about sea otters eating urchins, but often sea otters will target larger urchins and not the smaller ones that the sea stars go after. There has been progress on this front. Like, I know that there are groups, state groups in Northern California, especially, that are looking at trying to remove urchins from the coastline to give kelp a chance. There are people looking at restoring kelp beds using seeding technology derived from mariculture or aquaculture endeavors. We're seeing more urchins from California to Alaska, but it's having like localized effects in these places.
We covered the sea star wasting pandemic of 2013 in an earlier episode on the podcast. As sea stars died off in these mass numbers, their prey, sea urchins, quickly overpopulated. Now, sea urchins feed on the roots of kelp, and this led to a collapse of many bull kelp forest ecosystems that are still recovering today. Another culinary fan of the urchin, the sea otter. Now, they feed on larger urchins than sea stars do, but their role in this regard is equally valuable. This is part of the reason there has been such a concentrated effort to recover sea otters in the Pacific Northwest. After being hunted to near extinction in the first quarter of the 20th century, recovery efforts have turned into overdrive in the last two decades, and thousands of sea otters are now back in the water, primarily in kelp forests where they belong. And while this has been met with some controversy, as it has impacted large-scale commercial fishing operations in particular due to new restrictions on methodologies and newfound competition for urchins and crabs, kelp forests are up to 40% more productive, which is measured by the number of species per acre and the carbon they sequester when sea otters are present.
Definitely, yeah. It's been measured in some specific areas. Like, I have a collaborator called Tom Bell who works at Woods Hole now, and he's been working on looking at kelp bed canopy coverage. So he uses satellite data, and his data have shown that around Sitka in Southeast Alaska, for example, there's been very notable returns of kelp beds in areas that sea otters have been reintroduced.
Nothing more joyful than watching a sea otter enjoy himself or herself. Yeah. Okay, so kelp forests are pretty awesome and important. But what about kelp farms? And what exactly is a kelp farm? Is it just a natural kelp forest that someone can harvest from? Well, yes and no. They are true commercial operations like any terrestrial farm, but with some unique differences.
So kelp farms, I would go agricultural with this. It's like a farm on land. It should be controlled. It should be highly planned to help reduce any kind of negative consequences from poor planning, like loss of infrastructure. And depending on the state, it's also the biology is highly controlled. Like, for example, in Alaska, we cannot do strain selection. We have to collect parent broodstock from the wild from more than 50 parents at a time to seed our entire farm. And that ensures, it's a conservative approach to try to prevent any kind of monoculture that might compete with wild kelp stocks. And so that's something Alaska's doing. Other states aren't quite that strict. It doesn't mean that they have bad management. It just, it means that it doesn't mean anything. We're still learning so much about how kelp farm genetics might influence wild populations, but it is a highly controlled endeavor.
I asked Tiffany how one goes about setting up a kelp farm. With terrestrial farming, you typically need to buy and control the land, which has also led to a lot of social justice issues in the world of agriculture. And to me, this seemed potentially even more complicated with coastal waters.
It might be a little bit easier in Alaska just because it has such a small population along the coast relative to other states. But there's generally you find a piece of undeveloped, in some places you won't find undeveloped coastline easily. But anyway, you find a piece of water space that's not a priority space for other stakeholders is a good first approach, i.e. if you have dive fisheries around, if you have salmon fisheries around, you want to make sure you don't step on their toes too, because they might come up and oppose your farm. And so anyway, the way it works in Alaska is you locate an area that you think would be good for seaweed farming, and you don't buy the water. No one can buy the water. It's a public resource. I think federally, no one can own water spaces. Anyway, you apply for a site lease of that spot, and it goes through this rigorous application period with consultation from various organizations, consultation with the local communities, and if there are local tribal organizations, consultation with them too. And so for Alaska, it has traditionally taken about 2 years for a farm site to be approved for leasing. And I know that our application kind of triggered these other cascading considerations. For example, all right, so there's this farm and they want this much space, but like how much as a state do we allow for a single farm plot? You know, we can't just allow for a straight up 10 square kilometer plot, can we? And so Alaska has instituted this mandate where a single farm cannot take up more than one third of a given bay. And that's to help regulate a monopoly in certain areas, and then also potentially negative environmental impacts from that farm operation. But I do want to mention that it's not all about commercializing water spaces relative to Western norms. Up here, there's also a lot of sensitivities with tribal ownership. And so there are certainly disagreements about what spaces or who's managing what space. And so even though there's not a lot of coastal development there, you still got to really think about the other stakeholders that value that area.
Absolutely. And then what is for the average kelp farm, how big is it roughly?
Oh gosh. It's I don't think there's a standard. And for me, this is kind of a fun conversation in terms of what we allow for kelp farm sizes. So you're going to choose your size based on your business model and also your environmental ethics. I'll put an asterisk on that. And also how much capital you have to build a farm, right? So you have at least three big considerations. And right now there's not a lot of, we don't really understand how large a farm should or shouldn't be for environmental concerns. And there's a lot of talk about what is large scale farming? What is small scale farming? I know that on listening to some of Bren Smith's podcast interviews, for him, small scale farming is 20 to 40 acres. And that's totally legitimate. But like in some of the spots I see in Southeast Alaska, like we have a 100 acre site lease. We're farming 30 acres of that right now. And like, I wouldn't call that large scale based on the surrounding environment we're operating in. But others might just based on the numbers alone without context. And so I think we do have a lot of ground to make up in the industry to better understand how we define this, or even if it matters, how we talk about it. What parameters are we paying attention to?
Kelp farming is at a critical intersection right now of growth and relative infancy. It is the fastest growing form of marine aquaculture in the world, accounting for 50% of all global marine production. Yet it's still so new, commercially speaking, that there are no clear protocols in place. It's important that we learn our hard lessons from scaling terrestrial farming and not repeat those mistakes. This means carefully monitoring ecosystem health as we grow these farms, avoiding trying to modify and crossbreed kelp for the sole purpose of scale and efficiency that brings with it the need for pesticides and other chemical interventions, ensuring we are respecting local coastal communities and prioritizing smaller scale local ownership over large scale corporate ownership and operations, and so forth. Tiffany's team operates a 30-acre kelp farm in Alaska, so I asked her what that looks like day-to-day as an example.
Let's take that 30-acre farm you mentioned as an example. I think you said 30 acres, right?
Yeah, that's our active growing space.
Okay. Maybe just help understand like how productive is that 30 acres? What kind of annual yield does it produce?
Okay, so let's see. This 30 acres, we are producing. So first of all, we grow currently two species of kelp. We're growing sugar kelp and ribbon kelp. And more background about the site is that the site's called Doyle Bay. It's on Western Prince of Wales Island. And it is a lower energy site. And so when you think about kelp productivity, like one thing like that the Eastern markets have shown us is that site selection is king. Like really where you place your farm dictates the productivity of that farm more than anything else. And so anyway, Doyle Bay is a low energy site and we are producing about 3 pounds per foot of line. I don't really report in acres, like pounds per acre, because everyone has a slightly different grow out strategy. And when you're talking farm to farm, it's really helpful to know what the productivity per foot of line is. But for that 30 acre farm plot, I think this year we're projecting to grow 190,000 pounds of kelp.
Okay, 190,000 pounds of kelp for over the year. Are you also harvesting any shellfish or any other life within that kelp forest?
Not yet. We do have oysters in our business model, and we're working towards that. For example, this winter, I'm learning how to cultivate oyster larvae from scratch because Alaska doesn't have its own hatchery. And so we have really bad seed security up here. And so before we start operating with our own oysters, we need to know we can secure seed. And so in the next few years, we hope to add oysters to the scheme.
And oysters can also help make a kelp forest healthier, more productive as well, correct?
It can help, yeah. So it can go both ways, actually. So kelp can help oysters in that the oysters can feed on particulate organic matter that's coming from the kelp. And there are a lot of studies that show that those oysters are bivalves. They grow so much faster and their nutritional content's better. And then vice versa, the wastes coming from the oysters can help or can feed the kelp. So a lot of nitrogen, if the system is low in nitrogen, because it's the middle of the summer, that nitrogen from the oysters can make it to the kelp and be a nutrient supplement.
So how capital intensive is it to set up a kelp farm operation? Well, it turns out far less intensive than a typical terrestrial farming operation. And this is again due to the high growth, low input nature of kelp. I asked Tiffany what kind of capital would be needed to set up a small, let's say 10 acre kelp farm as an example.
I'm going to assume that this operation is vertically integrated because that's how most are right now. And so I would say probably about $250,000 at the cheapest for like everything, right? So that includes the infrastructure, that includes the boats, that includes hiring specialists, your own, like that includes me, like an in-house scientist. Not every operation needs that. And so you might be able to go cheaper. But that's about the ballpark for what we're doing in Alaska. But certainly, like talking to or listening to Brent Smith, I know he started a 20-acre farm for, or maybe 10 acres, for about $20,000 to $30,000. And it really is going to depend on what resources you already have. Like if you already have a boat, sweet. If you're installing infrastructure in a low energy site where you don't need to counter strong currents and waves, that's a huge benefit too. So they're based on site selection and using the resources around you, you can really reduce that value.
And then if your 30 acre kelp farm is producing, I think you said 190,000 pounds a year of kelp today, then maybe a 10 acre could produce 60,000 or so?
Yes. Theoretically, yes.
Now, in the last 60 years, fish farming has grown over 50 times. We now have reached a point where 75% of all the salmon we eat across this planet comes from a salmon farm, not the wild ocean. And while this practice was originally seen as a positive to minimize wild fishing and the issues that can cause in large volumes, what we are seeing today from these massive, large-scale salmon farms are strikingly similar to the issue we see in large-scale, single-crop terrestrial agriculture in terms of the negative ecosystem environmental impacts, which in turn contribute to global warming as we replace natural carbon sinks with industrial carbon emissions. So how does kelp farming potentially compare?
And I've seen videos and images of these just huge, huge pens of, it looks like millions of salmon penned in, being fed through automated feeder systems and just this like big industrialized fish farm. And even though I don't know all the details on it and impact, my radar goes off when I see these images and I'm like, there's got to be some negative, you know, kind of components of just mono. We know monocropping, monoculture farming and land has not been very good and has led to a lot of issues. And those big fish farms that just only have millions of salmon seem like an ocean version of that. And I could be wrong. Maybe there isn't any kind of negative byproduct of that. But again, when I see any form of mono agriculture, my just radar goes off no matter where it is. So how should we think about the regenerative nature of kelp farming as compared to other forms of kind of large ocean farming?
Yeah. I think that's an appropriate radar to have, considering the context of all of our other industrial and applications thus far in human history. Having a large seaweed farm operation of potential monocultures should be a concern for a few reasons. I touched on earlier the genetic pool issue that might exist. You certainly don't want to overcrowd wild kelp populations and lose that diversity in their gene pool. But what's kind of cool about seaweeds is that they're less likely to have these huge negative impacts on the local environment, primarily because they're a zero input crop, which means you don't need to fertilize them. You don't need to add anything to them. You just need to have structure for them to grow on. And so just by that alone, you're already reducing a lot of the negative effects that you might see in other aquatic cultivation setups like salmon farming. Sometimes those salmon can be overfed and that food sinks to the bottom. There's a buildup of organic matter and it causes dead zones. That's less likely with seaweed farming. I do wonder though, it gets talked about with carbon sequestration, growing tons and tons of kelp and then sinking it in the middle of the ocean. And so those are things that I would be looking towards in terms of, is that a smart decision? Is that safe for the environment we're utilizing for our human solutions? But generally seaweeds are pretty low impact relative to other cultivation strategies.
And you touched on this earlier, they also regenerate at kind of an alarming rate. I mean, I looked up a foot a day, which already blew my mind. You mentioned possibly a meter a day.
Yeah.
That just is like, it almost feels like science fiction, having anything grow at that rate.
It is. It does feel like science fiction. I have a friend and colleague that just finished his PhD at the University of British Columbia, and he was working with bull kelp, and he would take the blades off bull kelp and put it in a flume and recorded it over a 24-hour period. And you can just see that it grew like 10 centimeters, just that one blade without the rest of its body. And it is amazing. So kelps are regenerative in that because they can accumulate biomass quickly, there is an opportunity to use them in localized areas for remediation, whether it be nutrient like runoff from agricultural lands, wastewater output from faulty human facilities. But we have to be really clever in how we design those systems and realistic with what that biomass can take up in those localized areas.
Switching gears a bit, what are the nutritional qualities of kelp? is this something good for our health? And if it is, well, how in the world do we find more ways to eat it?
Kelp is a highly nutritious food, right? Like, what are some of the nutrition qualities of kelp?
Oh, yeah. So, and that's a good update. Yeah, that's a good point in terms of what we need to pay attention to. I'll go back to that. So, yeah, kelp's very nutritious. It has a lot of calcium, a lot of it has a lot of iodine, which can also be a negative. I know this gets talked about a lot. Too much iodine can be bad for your body. Kelps are very high in it, so we probably shouldn't eat a pound every day kind of thing. On that note, I do watch, I don't know if you ever watched that show Alone. It's the survival show. Mm-hmm. And they almost exclusively eat seaweeds because that's all of it that's available to them. And only one person I think has gotten iodine sickness. So that's kind of my metric for measurement. It's like, you know, if I eat seaweed every day, I think I'm going to be okay.
Worked on the reality show.
Let's see. They're also high in fiber, which was something that I wasn't aware of, but it's super important for our bodies. And then a lot of micronutrients. Some seaweeds are known to have a lot of B12, which can be hard to find, especially for vegan diets. Mm-hmm. And going back to what we need to think about when we're growing food, you know, one thing that's happened in terrestrial agriculture with strain selection and monocultures is that the same biomass today isn't necessarily as nutritious as the same biomass of yesteryear. There's been a lot of efficiencies in growth systems that have allowed biomass to accumulate quickly. And that's definitely, I mean, that's great for business, but only recently are we starting to learn that that has resulted in a reduction in nutritional content. And so when we advance the seaweed industry, we do need to consider nutrition. In my opinion, nutrition is one of the strongest arguments for using seaweed in food more than anything else. And we really need to pay attention to how we steward the nutrition of these future crops.
Kelp is absolutely a superfood. It has tremendous protein efficiency with 5 grams of protein every 65 calories. It is rich in fiber and omega-3, and it's a source of vitamins A, C, and E. Given so much marine life lives off kelp, ranging from small invertebrates to large marine mammals, well, that should signal how healthy kelp can be for all of us. But why don't you see more kelp products on restaurant menus or in grocery stores? Or more broadly speaking, more seaweed overall? It tends to be confined in dried snacks and a sushi side dish, from what I can tell. So is there truly a big gap between how kelp can be prepared and used in our diets and how it's being offered today?
Oh yeah, there is a massive, massive gap. And I think that's something that our company is trying to take head on, because the way that we want to use seaweeds or introduce seaweeds to consumers is we want it to be kind of an everyday household option. Kind of, it's a vegetable. It should just be another opportunity for mealtime and not this like specialized thing that you present to your friends. And so, but on that topic, like people, Westerners do not know how to use seaweed in daily meals. It seems to confuse us. We're not sure what recipes it can go with, because whenever we see seaweed, we're used to seeing it in an Asian context. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to reinvent how seaweed looks for a Western context. And there are companies out there doing a really good job with that. I know this is an Asian food, but like Atlantic Sea Farms has a kimchi product that they make, and it's super accessible and delicious. And then there's a lot of companies in California using seaweeds as ingredients and value added foods that are more traditional for Western palates.
Is there a reason, like when do you think we'll get to a point, or will we, where seaweed is also regularly available in the produce section, meaning it's available in some, like it's kind of raw form that allows people to prepare it in a variety of ways? Cause that's, you know, most vegetables, right? We can get them in a prepared form, or you can, you know, get them as an accessory to a meal, but for the most part, they're sold raw and people prepare them based on their culture and their tastes. And, you know, there's so many things you can do with such a like wide range of produce. I think of like a bell pepper and like the 100 different dishes I use a bell pepper in, right? There's such a wide variety. Where do you think we'll get there with seaweed? And you know, are there any grocery stores, even in places like Southeast Alaska or places that are maybe more oriented to kelp today that are experimenting with that? Or is it just not on any produce shelves?
It's on some, but I think, and I haven't, I think Seagrove Kelp is the only company producing that kind of product. I know Atlantic Sea Farms has a blanched product that you can throw into meals anywhere, but Seagrove is trying to provide a raw, unblanched, frozen product. And so one issue with this is the shelf stabilization. You're not going to find fresh seaweed that hasn't been frozen in a produce aisle for, I'm sure, another decade or so. We're just not at that level for large-scale consumerism. But certainly, we have frozen kelp, raw frozen kelp available at some stores in Seattle and some stores in Southeast Alaska. And I just saw my first wild sighting of our product being used by a consumer that I had no relation to on social media. So that was really exciting. And he just went down, grabbed the raw kelp, took it home and used it in a dish the way that he would use other ingredients. And it was like, yes, it's like, there's someone doing it. and so that, I think it just has to, like that, those introductions have to continue. People have to know that the kelp is available. I know in Ketchikan, I have friends that have gotten raw kelp from me. And even though I've shown them what to do, they're still uncomfortable using it. And so there really is, people just have to get used to it and not be afraid of a new ingredient.
It seems one of the key hurdles in making kelp a more regular part of our diets is the processing and handling infrastructure Tiffany is talking about here. It's not shelf stable in its raw form like common terrestrial produce, and can't just be plucked out of the ocean exactly as is and put into our kitchens and restaurants. So expect to see a lot more innovation here, and as the demand starts to pick up, the infrastructure needed to support it will too.
So one thing with kelp that we have realized in the processing stage is that the tissues don't stay stable by themselves for very long anyway. Like I know that I can keep kelp biomass happy in a recirculating tank for maybe 3 days. Maybe if it had the right nutrients for a week and a half. But this becomes something that grocery stores would have to be right on top of. And I think it would work if, I'm jumping around now. Are you familiar with Monterey Bay seaweeds?
No.
I think an operation like that, so he has land-based culture where he's growing about a half dozen different species of seaweeds, and they can go and harvest multiple times a month if they want to. And I think if there was an operation like that, that was year round, had fresh seaweed at like carefully cultured parameters, that can go straight from that onshore farm to a grocery store, a local grocery store, that would be a no-brainer. But it's going to require this like network or collaborations with grocery stores. Like sending fresh seaweed from Alaska to Seattle for something to be sold raw, fresh in the store is a significant challenge that I don't see us overcoming in the next wee while.
Yeah, so there's definitely some infrastructure needs there. In terms of, for help people understand how kelp could be incorporated in the diets, what terrestrial sort of produce would you compare it most to? Is it most similar to a leafy green or like a cabbage, or in terms of, you know, how you might prepare it, what would you sort of compare it to?
Yeah, it's kind of a hybrid model. We like to talk about kelp being similar to spinach in a lot of ways, especially blanched spinach in terms of texture and the utility. Like you can use kelp and spinach in so many different dishes and it's totally fine. I would argue that you can use kelp in even more dishes. Like for example, I love baking with kelp in like a sourdough bread, but I won't necessarily make a spinach sourdough loaf, but
interesting.
Kelp is delicious.
In that example, is kelp sort of adding sort of, is it more taking the role of like what rosemary might do, or an herb in a baked in a bread and adding flavor? Yeah. Or is it actually taking a core part of the the sort of the substance of the bread?
It can do both. So sourdough loaves, I like to have it kind of like a rosemary addition, more of a garnish, but incorporated inside. And then you can also, we have some recipes for like a kelp scone, kelp bagels, and another kelp bread. And there's a lot of kelp in some of those recipes. So it's a substantial part of it.
Just last month, a startup called Aqua, A-K-U-A, raised $3 million for their kelp burgers. They're also making kelp jerky and kelp pasta. We'll put a link to them in our description. I personally have been cooking more and more with kelp noodles. They have a much different texture than traditional pasta, but like anything new, as you eat it more and more, your palate starts to adjust as well. What was a challenge for me at first is now something I look forward to. We can expect this demand to pick up, and with it, kelp farming operations. So I asked Tiffany what she thinks the keys are to scaling this industry the right way.
Well, you know, I'm not really against fast growth of the industry, but with that does come like just some infrastructure concerns in the water. But this is something farmers are going to be watching because they don't want to lose their gear either. And so things like lost buoys, if there's a poor anchoring system with a farm, that whole farm might just be dislodged in a storm event, and it adds marine debris to our seafloor, which we don't need. And so, I mean, there are always those kind of concerns with any kind of aquaculture setup. Something I'm more concerned about, not the hands-on stuff, is how we think about the market space and how we talk about, I know that there's a big push for kelp to expand quickly because of potential carbon markets and climate solutions. And that's what I'm more concerned about, is the damage that we might accidentally do by ignoring some baseline things with these carbon markets. For example, right now, kelp, I don't know a single kelp farm that is carbon neutral. It takes a lot of fuel to go out and grow kelp. And so if we are already starting at a carbon deficit with these farms, and then we're applying a carbon market on top of that, like those are the things I worry about. We just have to make sure that the equations are balanced.
Yeah. And it's a good reminder too, because there's a couple things that I take issue with the carbon markets. One of them is just more a kind of a macro level. You know, there's some situations where companies, rather than lowering their own emissions of their operations, are kind of foregoing that and, you know, offsetting. And it, you know, it is a way where it's like, okay, yeah, your accounting looks good now, but we're not actually net lowering our global emissions in this way. So there's that, you know, kind of danger of it. But there's also, you know, in the UN, there's a UN report that came out this year around the carbon sequestration of indigenous controlled and owned tropical forests versus government and corporate protected tropical forests for the sake of carbon sequestration, where they're also not allowing agriculture and mining, where they're minimizing it to a large degree versus unprotected forests. And even in those cases, the indigenous controlled forests are sequestering about twice as much carbon as the protected ones. And that's just because indigenous people are much more familiar with the type of agroforestry, because some form, like certain forms of agriculture in the right way, can actually make an ecosystem more productive. It isn't like, I think people sometimes think any form of agriculture is depleting an ecosystem. That's not the case. Yeah. Some forms of agriculture actually benefit an ecosystem, and many indigenous communities have been practicing that for many years. And then you have other issues like, you know, natural fire breaks to minimize wildfires that indigenous people are better adept at setting up. Whereas some of these protected forests, where they're just racing to plant as many trees as possible, then you also have like the case of California. You know, you have, you know, you're building on top of a drought-driven land, and then too many trees can actually compete for water and dry out everything. And I think that's part of the reason we're seeing an influx of wildfires too. So there's reasons to believe in this, you know, this UN report that terrestrial forests in some cases are not often best managed by these corporate government initiatives to protect them versus indigenous control, as an example. So is there also that risk with kelp forests? Like if all of a sudden there's a big pile of money that goes into funding a kelp forest just for the purpose of producing those kind of carbon offsets and the economics that way. But, you know, it's not actually being managed day to day in a thoughtful way.
Yeah, it's definitely possible. I would say that there's lower risk being just considering the context of the farm. Like, it's removed from the seafloor most of the time, and so there's not a lot of opportunity for enhancing its local environment already. Certainly, the water chemistry will change. We are trying to learn. Well, one thing to think about on that topic is just indigenous control generally. I guess one concern would be that this industry grows so fast that we exclude marginalized communities. And that's not such a biological thing, but that's certainly an important human facet to the society. And that can affect how the industry grows. Because a lot of the time Westerners tend to focus on very specific details and don't see the whole picture. And so it's kind of hard to answer that, because I might not be seeing the whole picture from something right now. And what am I missing? And I think that's just something like having a slower build to the industry allows us to be a little bit more introspective about the interactions between human structure and wild biology.
I was curious to hear Tiffany's thoughts about supply and demand. Does she see one as a bigger bottleneck over the other right now for the kelp farming industry? Turns out it's kind of a chicken and egg situation.
Yeah, it's an interesting conversation. It's kind of a black box and almost a chicken and an egg thing too. So I would say that right now, previous to now, the conversation was like, there's no market. And you know, there's certainly some truth to that, but I think each business experiences that differently, first of all. But as a holistic viewpoint, I think that we are definitely growing enough kelp right now and meeting a lot of the demands of the marketplace. I personally feel like I see farms or interest in farming, and this is Alaska, mind you, because other places like California and Washington, they can't farm yet. But in Alaska, I see more interest in farming growing faster than product or market interests. But I think that market interests are growing faster in the lower 48. And it's kind of a multi-level conversation. So right now, the industry is very small scale, and we're meeting the needs of a lot of small businesses and value-added products. But there's these huge businesses lurking in the background, like Purina Pet Foods, or biofuels, or just these huge things that we need, or feeding cows, kelps to like millions of cows across the US that we cannot grow enough kelp for right now. And I'm not sure if like what that even looks like. And so it's almost a step function. Right now, I think it feels like there's a pretty good balance between production and use of that production, but we need to take a big step, because these pet food industries want that kelp biomass, but they don't have evidence of enough biomass being produced or stability over years. Because for companies that are huge, they need stability. And so that's something that the industry will be working towards meeting demands for.
I was going to ask you about the cattle topic. I know it's like a very specific and niche thing, but what's been on my mind is I've also read these reports that, you know, kelp is being used, and seaweed in general is being used as a feedstock for cattle, and actually is showing, you know, kind of lowering or reducing the amount of gas they produce, and there's methane in that gas, and, you know, it's all of a sudden, like, versus especially the industrialized grains. And also you mentioned B12, a lot of cattle, people don't realize, have to get B12 supplements because they're fed, you know, and these industrialized farms, such poor nutrition, like poorly nutritious, you know, kind of processed grain, that they're not getting the B12 themselves. And that's another example. And of course that B12 can come from the kelp. So, hey, if all of a sudden this seafood feed has another source of B12 for our cattle, and it reduces some of their methane output via the gas, well, this is a good thing and we're hitting our climate targets. I look at that and say, well, hold on. Like we really actually should be moving our livestock agriculture to also regenerative, not this kind of large scale industrial complex we have. You know, cattle should be rotational grazing and should be part of a thriving, you know, kind of terrestrial farming ecosystem with that natural grazing versus being penned up at, you know, at massive scale and fed, you know, now seaweed instead of a grain. So is there, in that example, is there any risk that like seaweed could sort of help perpetuate the wrong type of cattle farming? And these things are so layered and complex and I always oversimplify them in my mind, and I probably am doing that here again, but that's just something that came up for me.
Yeah. That's fun to think about. I'll probably simplify it too. I don't really have an answer for that. Mostly because I'm not in the cattle industry and I don't know what they're thinking. But there could be, like, looking at human nature, there is potential for the cattle industry to take on the seaweed as a feedstock and claim these magical benefits from it while also not reducing much of their impact at all. I think just human nature dictates that could happen. Whether it is feasible to happen is another question. I don't know if we can produce that much kelp, you know, and so, because there's a lot of dairy cows and there's a lot of beef cows out there. Like, there's actually so much. And I don't know if we can produce enough seaweed to feed all of them. And so for that to happen, like, I don't know, you could maybe affect like a quarter of the cattle industry and reduce methane emissions by a quarter. But what matters? What's the bottom line? Like, is a quarter reduction enough? And really, we might not have to reduce any cattle if we reduce everything everywhere else. And so it's just kind of this huge fluid societal flow of what we prioritize as valuable and what we want to perpetuate. I mean, I think we need to reduce our consumption of meat generally. And if we held ourselves accountable for ethical emissions, then that would kind of just be forced upon us. But yeah, I don't know. That's a great question.
Yeah. These are really tricky things to evaluate, and there's so much kind of going on at once. But I agree with you also, we need to reduce our meat consumption, particularly on the industrialized kind of like meat production, right? Yeah. I mean, I take far less issue with, you know, sort of the natural rotational grazing of regenerative livestock farms that are also producing other crops and doing it in a sort of, you know, biodynamic regenerative way. But the large scale industrialized livestock is just, I've had many scientists on the podcast that have said industrialized livestock farming is the single biggest threat to biodiversity collapse we have. And there's a lot of data that kind of shows that. So that particular type of meat production is the one we need to focus on, not necessarily all forms.
Finally, in Tiffany's final remarks, she shared just how hopeful she is for the future of kelp farming and its role as a critical source of a sustainable food supply future.
I tell people all the time, I don't really know a product on this planet that we couldn't produce with seaweed. I mean, obviously we can't turn seaweed into beef, but we can make substitutions that are acceptable.
You can make seaweed burgers. That's happening. Yeah, but absolutely.
We can make almost any biomaterial, pharmaceuticals, nutraceuticals. Like, there's at least, I know two species of seaweeds that have been identified to fight COVID, or the virus, not the symptoms. So it's just, seaweeds are amazing. We're just learning about them right now. I mean, the diversity is amazing, and the Western world has only touched literally a handful of those in an in-depth way.
Well, Tiff, I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day and your schedule to chat with us and help sort of spread more of this information about kelp farming and its potentials and kelp forests. It's really valuable info for people to have, and appreciate what you've dedicated yourself to. And And I know you said in the beginning that you don't think it's fate, but I'll be on the camp that I think maybe it is. And it's a nice, yeah, I think there's something romantic about fate as well. If you can allow yourself to sort of embrace it.
Yeah. Cheers for having me on, James.
Well, big thanks to Tiffany for joining us. Thanks to all of you as always. I encourage you to get out there and try to find some kelp and enjoy it and look more into it. Thank you, as always, for supporting Animalia and supporting this big, beautiful planet and all the life on it. Till next time.